You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, the president just gave an incredible speech, knocked it out of the park. I am going to be sharing parts of that with you throughout the next 3 hours and riffing on some of them extensively. My new book, The Crash of 2016, is saying if we don't put back into place the foundational stuff that kept this country stable from the 1930s until the 1980s, and really, if you want to take it right up to, you know, when Phil Graham, his wife Wendy, of course, was on the board of Enron, and Ken Lay desperately wanted to play in the commodity trading game with energy. Phil Graham passed Graham-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which allowed the banks to go from an $80 billion market in 1999 of securitized mortgages to a $800 trillion market, according to the Bank for International Settlements in 2008. This is, keep in mind, the GDP of the entire planet, $65 trillion, an $800 trillion market. This is funny money, phony baloney money. In 2008, that crashed down to about $500 trillion market. It's back up to a $700 trillion market. And as we reported on this program a couple of days ago, and I find it interesting, over, you know, Newsmax, the conservative website, is talking about this exact same thing in many of the exact same terms. The banksters, you know, now that Dodd-Frank has made it harder for them to do this with mortgages, in other words, to securitize mortgage payments and turn those into derivatives and crash the entire world economy with it, they're doing it with rentals. They're buying up properties. You've got the Blackstone Group buying 1,700 houses in Atlanta in one day alone. I mean, it's the new bubble. It's the new burst. C. Edmund Wright is with us, conservative commentator, contributor of Breitbart, an American thinker, author of WTF, How Karl Rove and the Establishment Lost Again. His website, C. Edmund Wright, WRIGHT.com. C. Edmund Wright, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Make sure that's Edmund with a U, too. So
there you go.
Put an O in there.
Okay, E-D-M-U-N-D. You know what you ought to do is see if you can get the misspellings. Like I've got, you know, the four different ways that my name could be spelled. I've got the URLs for all of them. But anyway, just a thought.
You're dumbing down my website. Okay. I'm sure to increase traffic.
It helps. Let me get this straight. My understanding of what your position is that the banksters crashed our economy, and they've now gotten much bigger than they were before. They, you know, we have six banks that have assets equal to 65% of the entire GDP of the United States, and therefore we need to deregulate them even more. Do I have that right?
Well, let me tell you, and I agree with some of what you said coming in, by the way, Tom. But a lot of what's happened is the banksters are in cahoots with government gangsters, and a lot of times the problem is not under or over regulation. It's just very bad regulation.
I don't disagree with that at all. I would say that. Go ahead.
Sarbanes-Oxley and mark-to-market accounting was probably one of the worst regulations ever written into any industry.
Well, it didn't make the banking or the private equity market real happy, but it certainly didn't cause the great crash. I mean, that had nothing to do with why you've got $800 trillion in derivatives out there.
I would disagree with that. I would say that what mark-to-market did, and I understand the thinking behind it, the problem is what you had was good intentions, and then you had bureaucrats who've never been in business write it. What you had there was when the mortgages crashed, as their value, the undergirding value crashed, the banks had to immediately reflect that on their balance sheets, even though those mortgages were still being paid, those houses were not being sold. So what happened is we had a liquidity crisis, and the whole thing crashed, and that led to TARP, which then didn't end up being TARP.
But see, if it was all mortgages, I'd agree with you, but it wasn't all mortgages, as you well know. You know, it was all these derivatives on top of that. This is toxic stuff that the Fed is buying $45 billion a month worth of right now.
Now, this is where we're going to agree. The derivatives the derivatives were, I mean, they were, this is why, you know, your neighbor's double wide gets repossessed and then the nation of Iceland goes bankrupt. Okay, that's because all these derivatives built in all this contagion. Now, I would say that the derivatives came about because the banks were forced to give mortgages they didn't want to and they had to sell them to somebody. You would probably say it just came about because of Wall Street greed.
Now, if you're going to try and peddle that idea that Jimmy Carter somehow forced banks to give mortgages to poor people, principally poor people of color, it's more often than not characterized as a rather racist argument. I would challenge you very simply to please give me one sentence from that law, from the Community Reinvestment Act, which by the way, did ban redlining. It said you can no longer say, oh, this neighborhood is black, therefore we're not going to loan in this neighborhood. What that law said is loans have to be based on the creditworthiness of the individual home buyer, not the neighborhood itself. If you can give me one sentence from that law
that
backs up that assertion, I will apologize to you. But I'm telling you, you're spreading misinformation, frankly.
Well, okay. The Community Reinvestment Act led to a much wider pool of mortgages for people, black, white, yellow, red, green.
But mostly black, but mostly creditworthy black, because a black middle class was emerging in the United States, in large part because of Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty and because of laws against discrimination that conservatives have been fighting forever.
Well, at the risk, Tom, of calling those blacks racist because they ended up moving into white neighborhoods, so that's not the
You've got a very large black middle class neighborhoods in the United States. But the point is that there's nothing in the Community Reinvestment Act. There's nothing that forces a bank to do anything. What it does is it prevents a bank by law, and I would think that you would agree with this. It prevents a bank from saying, we're going to refuse to lend into a particular zip code or into a particular block or neighborhood simply because of the race of the people in that neighborhood.
No, I would agree with that. But what you are ignoring is the fact that some of those – see, there's two things that a mortgage is supported by. It's supported by the ability of the borrower to pay, but it's also supported by the value of the underlying collateral. And that's actually what mark-to-market triggered, by the way, was the value of the underlying collateral went away, and that was the first card or the first domino, if you will, that got pulled out. So what we had was neighborhoods whose collateral was not very valuable, and you might say it's racist. I would say it's reality.
Well, okay, we you know.
I mean,
there was no race, no, but we can get into the finer points of how neighborhoods and the value of individual homes within them rise or fall based on both demographics and economics and society and race and gentrification and everything else. And it's a fascinating topic. But none of that forces a bank to do a damn thing. Banks were never forced to do this. They were out there hustling. These banks were hustling. And I just don't get why you want to further deregulate them.
Well, first of all, I think they're overregulated now. I think Dodd-Frank is a series of disastrous regulations that has resulted now in fewer financial institutions.
Would you want to go back to pre-35?
I'm not going to buy that strong argument that we got to go back to 35 or to 2013. I think there's a different way we can go.
And that is?
Well,
first of all, 10 seconds. Sorry, we're out of time.
We can get too deep in the weeds of Dodd-Frank, but what it has done is it is under the premise, Tom, and you understand the premise was to get rid of too big to fail. The premise of getting rid of too big to fail, with lobbyists and other crony capitalists involved, and the big banks they're not free enterprise people. They're crony capitalists.
I got that, and they're not unique in that. We're going to have to leave that as the last word. CEdmundWright.com. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
See, Edmund Wright, thanks so much for dropping by today. Good talking with you. Oh, he's gone. Okay. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Andrew Campbell, senior producer over at The Big Picture, is on the line with us. Hey, Andrew. Good to see you.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, Alec, just this morning, in fact, I showed up without a sports coat, so you get to see me just sitting there in a T-shirt with Congressman Mark Pocan. Not a T-shirt, this shirt. with Congressman Mark Pocan for 15 minutes talking about ALEC and ALEC Exposed. It was a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, ALEC is trying to find new ways to further make its organization secretive. They're trying to change their status to a nonprofit, which would really make it a lot harder for people to really see what this corporate lobbying juggernaut is really up to.
Yeah, yeah. And this is by creating this new Jefferson Project. Plus, we are discovering what their new legislative agenda is. And we got the Lone Liberal Rumble.
Yeah, we'll have on Horace Cooper and Chris Holman, so it should be a fiery rumble, to say the least. We're going to start off by talking about Obamacare. The mainstream media has been all over the fact that the Obamacare website is back up and running, and it seems to be doing fairly well. On Monday alone, there were 700,000 visitors to the site, which was double any other Monday since it was first released back on October 1st.
Mm-hmm.
What the media is ignoring is why there was this website debacle in the first place. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that 36 states, led by Republican lawmakers and governors, refused to set up their own exchanges. And that's really just this overall pattern of sabotage by Republicans.
Yeah.
So we'll get into that.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, and?
We'll also be talking about the Pope. A Tea Party activist came out on World Net Daily criticizing the Pope and saying that Jesus Christ would be weeping in heaven if he heard what the Pope was saying about capitalism. The Pope has made some very high-profile comments recently about needing to do more to make a more equal and just society and talking about the tyranny of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into really, can Republicans really call themselves Catholics if they're really not following the principles of the church?
Yeah, or even Christians.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things you might want to do, Andrew, is look for, there's got to be a site someplace that aggregates all the quotes from Jesus about caring for the poor, poverty, things like that. And maybe we can throw a couple of good quotes up on the screen tonight.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. So what else?
We'll also be talking about the D.C. Council. They unanimously passed a minimum wage increase and also a measure for paid time off. This comes at a time when workers are protesting all over the country that there really needs to be a living wage. People just can't afford to live on what they're making from Walmart to fast food restaurants. So hopefully the D.C. action will inspire more debate and hopefully action across the country.
All right. So a lot going on, a lot of good stuff.
Yep.
And a lot of these things. And then Reverend Pastor Bullock is going to be with us tonight.
Yep.
Right?
We'll have him on from he's the founding member and national spokesperson of Change Agent Consortium, and we'll have him on to talk about what's going on in Detroit. Most people know that a judge ruled that Detroit can go ahead with its plans for bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Pensions are wiped out, and it's really a mess up there, and we'll get the latest from Pastor Bullock.
Yeah, the people who kept their end of the deal, the workers who took a pay cut in order to make sure that their pension was there, they're the ones who are getting screwed.
Yep.
And everybody else, not so much. It's amazing. Andrew Campbell. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking to you. We'll be back. Pastor D. Alexander Bullock will be with us toward the end of this hour. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about what the media isn't telling you about Detroit's bankruptcy. And in our third hour, Tea Party activist Jonathan Mosley, his website, Cure Socialism, right? He has come out and said that Jesus is weeping because of what the Pope is saying. So that's going to be an interesting conversation. Now, the president gave a speech this morning over at the Center for American Progress here in Washington, D.C. And I just have to say, in fact, Sam Sachs, who works over in the news, you know, on the TV side over at RT, came over and said, I think the president's been reading your book. Because he was actually using some of our phrases. Of course, they're not unique to me. I mean, some of the phraseology in the book is, when you're talking about economics, you know, pretty much all economists talk the same way. Like virtuous cycle, for example, the president used that phrase. Some of these things. But I want to just share a few clips from the president's speech with you today. And then I'll riff a little bit about them, and we'll go on to the next one. Here's these just kind of randomly selected. Here's one.
They may not follow the constant back and forth in Washington or all the policy details, but they experience in a very personal way the relentless decades-long trend that I want to spend some time talking about today. That is a dangerous and growing inequality and lack of upward mobility that has jeopardized middle-class America's basic bargain, that if you work hard, you have a chance to get ahead.
I believe
this is the defining challenge of our time, making sure our economy works for every working American.
Now, basically, let me translate that from friendly President Obama into partisan talk show Tom Hartman ease. Basically, what he said is 32 years of Reaganomics has gutted the American middle class. It's made the rich wildly richer. It's made working people wildly poorer. And the poor are even poorer than they were. And so inequality has expanded. And as inequality expands, society starts to fall apart. And this, he says, is the defining, I forget the word, battle, whatever the word was, of our time, the defining issue of our time. Now, if he says solving inequality is the defining issue of our time, what is it? Challenge, the defining challenge of our time. Then what he is essentially saying, in my opinion, let me rephrase that. If I was to say fixing inequality is the defining challenge of our time, which, by the way, I will gladly say, then what I'm saying is it's time to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Right? We did not have inequality like this when the top tax rate was 74% and corporations actually paid their fair share of taxes. Paid a third of the national tax bill. Now corporations are paying about 10% of the national tax bill, and you got people like Mitt Romney running around where 6-8 years in a row he pays no taxes at all on income that, you know, $10-$30 million a year. This is insane. I mean, it is time to roll back the Reagan tax cuts and go back to a top tax rate of 74%. When tax rates are above 50%, economies are stable, and inequality diminishes. Robert Reich has a movie about this out called Inequality for All. I don't know if it's still playing in the theaters or not, but it's brilliant. And I'm not even sure that he ties that to tax rates. I think he does, but you know, he points out that in 1929, when the top tax rate had been dropped in 1921 by Warren Harding, had been dropped from 91% down to 25%. By 1929, inequality was just where it is right now. And what was the first thing FDR did? Not the first thing, but one of the first things FDR did, he rolled back the Harding tax cuts. Obama needs to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. And members of Congress, Democrats, need to be talking about this. They need to, you know, Republicans, they'll stand up and say, oh, we need a flat tax, we need zero taxes, we need no taxes, we need no corporate tax. They'll say the craziest things. Why won't Democrats at the very least say, let's just roll back the damn Reagan tax cuts. Let's go back to an economy that in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and the first half of the 80s was the strongest economy the world had ever seen, a middle class that was the largest middle class the world had ever seen, in large part because of our tax policy. And in large part because of our trade policy. I mean, my one disappointment with the president's speech is that he didn't talk about the relationship between exports and imports, the fact that we have a trade deficit. But that's, you know, I'm willing to set aside my disagreements with him when I'm so blown away by my agreements with him. We have just 1 minute. Do you have another clip that's less than a minute? Sure. Here's a little more of President Obama.
It was Abraham Lincoln, a self-described poor man's son, who started a system of land-grant colleges all over this country so that any poor man's son could go learn something new.
Okay. Now, yesterday, remember, I was talking, I mean, it's like, people at the White House, thanks for listening to the program. I have been talking for, I don't know, just a few months, really. I mean, I always knew what a land-grant college was. I went to one briefly, but Michigan State University, but I never really understood the whole thing until I really started, you know, writing The Crash of 2016 and dug into this thing that Abraham Lincoln created more than 50 of these colleges where he gave a large enough chunk of land to the college that they could work that land in a variety of different ways, whether it was timber deals or cattle or farming or whatever. They could work that land to make enough money to so that the students could go to college for free. And here's the President of the United States referring to Abraham Lincoln's land-grant colleges. When we come back from the break, I'm going to play a clip of Jack Kennedy saying the same thing, which is actually where I first got turned on to it. And, you know, actually, we won't do that when we come back from the break because I got to work through the break, but we'll get to it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Actually, Shane says he's got it, so cool. We'll figure it out. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Now, have you still queued up President Obama talking about land-grant colleges, too? Let's play them back-to-back. Your choice. Which do you want to do first, Shane? Which is easiest for you? You got the president first? Okay, here's President Obama. You know, I've been ranting about this for some time, land-grant colleges, that Abraham Lincoln was following on the idea that the great presidents, right? The great presidents of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, all, you know, worked for free college education for everybody. The FDR did it, not for everybody, but he did it for all the GIs, the GI Bill. And it was functionally free in most places anyway by the time he was president. So here's the president talking about land-grant colleges.
It was Abraham Lincoln, a self-described poor man's son, who started a system of land-grant colleges all over this country so that any poor man's son could go learn something new.
And then here is President John F. Kennedy.
And those who say that what we are now talking about spoils our great pioneer heritage should remember that the West was settled with two great actions by the national government. One, in President Lincoln's administration, when he gave a homestead to everyone who went West, and in 1862 he set aside government property to build our land-grant colleges. This cooperation between an alert and progressive citizenry and a progressive government is what has made this country great, and we shall continue as long as we have the opportunity to do so.
Now, let me just give you a little context for that Kennedy quote, and Shane, I'm going to ask you to play the first maybe 5 or 10 seconds of it again, because I want to explain what Kennedy was talking about. In that speech, that clip came from a speech in which Kennedy was proposing Medicare. Medicare. Ronald Reagan was running around saying, if you give free health care to the elderly, that's going to be the road to socialism, and someday we're going to look back on when America was free as we are living under basically the heel of the Soviet boot. So when Kennedy says, when they say that what we're trying to do is, you know, I forget how he characterizes it, but, you know, he references they're attacking us, basically. This is a speech calling for free health care actually it was twofold. He wanted not just Medicare in this speech. When you read the whole speech, he actually said we should have something like the British system. I mean, that's in the speech as well. It's a pretty amazing speech. We have played it before in its entirety here on this program. But, you know, he's pitching, at the very least, let's make sure everybody who's retired has free health care, and it would be even better if we could give free health care to everybody. Here's President John Kennedy. Now, just catch this.
And those who say that what we are now talking about spoils our great pioneer heritage should remember that the West was settled with two great actions by the national government.
And you can stop right there. So in other words, they were saying back then the same thing they're saying right now. Oh, we're all pioneers. You know, it's all Davy Crockett. And Davy Crockett didn't need no damn Medicare, Obamacare. Medicaid, Social Security, didn't need any of that stuff, right? And Jack Kennedy says, oh, yeah, thumb in the eye. Give me a break. Come on. The West was settled out by Davy Crockett. The West was settled by Abraham Lincoln giving away land and sending people to college by giving away land. Okay, so that was President Obama. President Obama, here's some more from President Obama's speech, because we're just throughout the day here. I mean, we've got a few other debates. We've got a few other guests and a couple of topics that I want to talk about at some length, particularly Detroit. And we're going to get into that with Reverend Bullock in about 12 minutes from now. But this was such a great speech today. Here's another clip from President Obama's speech.
When farms gave way to factories, a rich man's son named Teddy Roosevelt fought for an 8-hour workday, protections for workers, and busted monopolies that kept prices high and wages low. When millions lived in poverty, FDR fought for Social Security and insurance for the unemployed and a minimum wage. When millions died without health insurance, LBJ fought for Medicare and Medicaid. Together, we forged a new deal, declared a war on poverty and a great society. We built a ladder of opportunity to climb and stretched out a safety net beneath so that if we fell, it wouldn't be too far and we could bounce back. And as a result, America built the largest middle class the world has ever known. And for the three decades after World War II, it was the engine of our prosperity.
And then came Ronald Reagan. See, this is what, you know, I realize it's probably not good politics to say that, although I think it is, frankly. But, you know, it was just the perfect spot. He could have said, and then Bill Casey conspired with the mullahs to hold the hostages in Iran. As President Bonnie Sauter has told us now in March of this year in the Christian Science Monitor. Jimmy Carter lost the election to Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter, who had been way ahead, because most Americans thought Ronald Reagan was a whack job. You know, Ronnie Reagan, they used to call him. We used to call him. So, you know, we had this great engine of prosperity, the American middle class, and then came Reaganomics.
But starting in the late 70s, this social compact began to unravel.
Yeah, you think?
Technology made it easier for companies to do more with less, eliminating certain job occupations. A more competitive world let companies ship jobs anywhere. And as good manufacturing jobs automated or headed offshore, workers lost their leverage. Jobs paid less and offered fewer benefits. As values of community broke down and competitive pressure increased, businesses lobbied Washington to weaken unions and the value of the minimum wage. As a trickle-down ideology became more prominent, taxes were slashed for the wealthiest, while investments in things that make us all richer, like schools and infrastructure, were allowed to wither. And for a certain period of time, we could ignore this weakening economic foundation, in part because more families were relying on two earners as women entered the workforce. We took on more debt financed by a juiced-up housing market. But when the music stopped and the crisis hit, millions of families were stripped of whatever cushion they had left.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, he read my book. Or, you know, it's just so, actually, you know, the president doesn't have to read my book to know this stuff. It's so obvious. And you'll notice he used the phrase trickle down. Now, I may be wrong on this, because I haven't listened to every presidential speech and I haven't done an extensive search, you know, using a good search engine like DuckDuckGo to exhaustively examine the internet. But I think he might be the second president in history to use the phrase trickle down. Because by the end of the Reagan presidency, I mean, Reagan was all in favor of trickle-down economics. He used the phrase. By the end of his presidency, it was pretty much discredited. George Herbert Walker Bush thought it was voodoo economics from before the Reagan presidency until obviously after. I mean, Bush raised taxes. It's, you know, arguably one of the reasons why he lost the election. I would say the biggest reason why George Herbert Walker Bush lost the election in 1992 was because he was up against one of the most brilliant politicians of our generation, Bill Clinton. Regardless of what you may think of all of his policies and everything else, he's just, you know, I've met the guy, and I've seen him speak and shared a stage with him, and I have never in my life seen anything like this. Bill Clinton is a savant. He's a political savant. He's a genius. And George Bush had no chance. But in any case, that said, if Obama is only the second president to use the phrase trickle down, we all know who we're talking about here. We're talking about Reagan. Now, remember just a minute ago I was saying, you know, the president is saying inequality. We've, you know, ever since the late 70s, late 70s, right, 78, 79, 80, what happened in 80? Reagan was elected president. Oh, yeah. Oh, amazing. Well, yeah, 78 and 79 were kind of rough years, in part because Jimmy Carter, I mean, Margaret Thatcher got elected in England in 78, okay? And Maggie Thatcher, the first thing she did was she busted the biggest and most powerful union in the history of England, which was the Coal Workers Union. First thing she did, busted that union. Nobody thought it was possible. And then she just went on a rampage. She started privatizing British industries. She started deregulating things. And Jimmy Carter started drinking some of that Kool-Aid. He said, you know, maybe we should do this. And because all the thoughtful people were writing about what Margaret Thatcher was doing. I mean, isn't it brilliant what Maggie Thatcher is doing over there in the UK? We should consider this. You know, from the third way kind of Democrats to obviously the Bill Kristol kind of, you know, and William Buckley kind of Republicans. And so Jimmy Carter in 79 and 80 deregulated the travel industry, which helped Louise and I make a lot of money in the early 80s. And, you know, I'm not saying it was a terrible thing, but in retrospect, I'd frankly rather have the old regulated travel industry, at least air travel industry. Deregulated the trucking industry. Ask anybody who used to be a trucker back before 78 compared to now. I mean, some bad stuff happened.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So the president's right when he says it started in the late 70s, but it really went on steroids in 1981 when Ronald Reagan came in. And emulating Maggie Thatcher as hero busted Patco. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we haven't picked up any phone calls yet this hour. Let's Sharon in Roanoke, Virginia. Hey, Sharon, how are you?
Hi, Tom. I was just wanted to make a few comments about the middle class and all the unions that have gone by the wayside. When my dad was growing up, he used to get full benefits to support his family back in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up across a 1969 newspaper from Grand Rapids, Michigan, with advertisements, and where you could have bought a bedspread for $6.99.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck roast was 59 cents a pound.
Right.
I mean, you could feed a family of four on one salary, and we never struggled.
Yeah.
And now my husband and I were in our late 50s, and we have to move out of Virginia because he needed to get another job because they don't pay very well here.
Wow.
And I just wanted to make that comment that people are moving to get better wages now all over the place.
Yeah, it is the impoverishment of America. I mean, that's what we're seeing is the impoverishment of America. And it's what we were predicting, those of us who were in the predicting business back in 1980 and 81 and really, I started getting insane about it maybe in 83, 84, as the Reagan agenda was becoming more and more obvious. You know, the Reagan agenda was to destroy the American middle class and create a bankster-based economy. And he did it. He did it. You're absolutely right. Sharon, thank you for sharing your story with us, and thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Frank watching Free Speech TV in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I just saw a fellow by the name of Wallace Turberville talking. He wrote the book, The Bankruptcy of Detroit. And all of this stuff starts to add up into a point where he was saying that, it might have been a planned, this bankruptcy. But
you mean planned as like over a 30-year period, or planned as in
over a period of time where they bought all the municipal bonds,
right?
And they started this little 2008 thing, which chipped into it,
right?
And finally, the whole thing, they cut down the. It's a shortage of cash.
This guy wrote a book about the crash of Detroit, about the bankruptcy of Detroit.
The bankruptcy of Detroit.
What's his name?
Wallace Turbeville.
How do you spell that?
T-U-R-B. I think it's A-V-I-L-L-E. And
I'd like to get him on as a guest. Thank you for the heads up on that, Frank.
But the thing, it's something that you've been talking about, and you've been talking about it straightforward, but it bounced off my head for some reason for years. But the point is, I remember Hubert Humphrey talking about the idea about the eagle. He has arrows in one hand and flowers, a wreath in the other hand, and the other claw. And he said, punish your enemies and you reward your friends. It's a political thing, like the potentate shooting each other, banging heads. Wallace Turbeville pointed out is they're going after the people, the African American
in particular,
voters of urban Detroit. They're being decimated.
Yep.
Not no longer a war between the titans, the politics.
No, I agree. This has been since 1981. The Bella Omnium et Omnium, it has been the war of all against all, only it's been against the working people of America, particularly those of color. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and one of my very favorite guests is with us today again, Reverend D. Alexander Bullock. He is the founder and national spokesperson for the Change Agent Consortium. And you can find that over on Facebook.com at ActionCAC. So Facebook.com/ActionCAC. Do I have that right, Reverend?
Facebook.com/ActionCAC. You can also go to ActionCAC.org as well.
Oh, okay. Great. That's even easier. ActionCAC, as in Change Agent Consortium, ActionCAC.org. So the courts have said that the one group of people who actually kept their deal, the workers of Detroit, who took pay cuts and vacation cuts and cuts in their benefits, like health care benefits, in order to know that they would have a good pension when they retired, that those people can be screwed. But the people who really didn't sacrifice anything and didn't make any kind of commitment, the bondholders and the banksters, they can be made whole. Do I have that right?
I think you've got it right. I think Judge Stephen Rhodes failed Detroit with this decision. 48 or so unions came together, put together a concession package somewhere between $150 to $200 million, attempted to negotiate in good faith with the state of Michigan, with Governor Rick Snyder, and with his appointee, Emergency Manager Kevin Orr. It's amazing that Judge Stephen Rhodes admitted that the emergency manager did not negotiate in good faith with working people, with the labor movement, with the unions in the city of Detroit. But despite that fact, and despite the fact that the Michigan State Constitution protects pensions, despite those two facts, the retirees in the city of Detroit are on the chopping block. And remember, there are a lot of stories coming out about these bloated pension payments. That's really not the truth of the case. Most folks are receiving minimal pension checks and need those checks to pay their heating bills, to pay their rent, to buy food to eat. And so really you have the most vulnerable citizens in the city of Detroit on the chopping block once again.
Right. Plus that's going to mean that there's less money to spend, less money in the pockets of average working people or retired people, in this case in Detroit, less money to spend, which is going to be less money in the community stores and in the neighborhoods, which is going to mean, the downward spiral, and it's going to be more money in the pockets of the Wall Street banksters.
Indeed. This really was a win for the Wall Street banks. It was all this controversy about whether or not Picasso and the paintings in the DIA would be on the chopping block versus right. detention. We actually saw so many people come to rescue the paintings as opposed to the people. And so I really think Detroit becomes ground zero for a continued assault on the poor, on working people, on the trade, union labor movement. And this was a really, I believe, a setback. People talk about the new Detroit that will emerge after bankruptcy. It will be a richer Detroit. It will be a smaller Detroit, but it will be a Detroit where poor and working class people are disenfranchised.
Yes, yes. My understanding is to talk about the paintings for a second, the Detroit Art Institute, where Louise and I used to go to Sunday services every Sunday back in the 70s when we lived there, when Self-Realization Fellowship, SRF, used to have their Sunday services there. And we'd wander around the Art Institute after church, you know, and it was just an amazing place. That art is still on the chopping block, isn't it? I mean, aren't the rich buddies of Rick Snyder still salivating at the possibility of buying this stuff?
Well, you know what? It's amazing. They've got the pensions. Now they want Picasso. Indeed, you're right. They have requested an independent audit of all of the assets of the city of Detroit, which would include the paintings and the artwork in the DIA. And so we are now, I believe, in the stage of Detroit as a flea market or Detroit as a swap meet.
Yeah. Detroit's being stripped.
Detroit is being stripped. I mean, from paintings, the state of Michigan picked up Belle Isle. I believe the water department is on the way. And so one of the key questions will be what assets, if any, will the city of Detroit have as it attempts to emerge from these bankruptcy proceedings to move forward?
That's amazing. I mean, the assets will still be there. They're just moving from public hands into private hands. They're going to be, you know, Donald Trump is going to own some of those paintings instead of the people of Detroit. I mean, not necessarily Donald Trump himself, but that level of kind of, you know, New York billionaire bankster.
That's right. Indeed, this is going to open up the door for what was publicly owned to become.
Is there any possibility, we're talking with Reverend D. Anderson, Alexander Bullock, excuse me, he's the founder and national spokesperson for Change Agent Consortium, the website actioncac.org or over at facebook.com/actioncac. Are there any steps left or is this a done deal?
I think we've got to go to the United States Supreme Court. This case has to get there. Of course, now we're talking about a longer timeline. Of course, there is a plan that has to be shaped and then authorized by Judge Stephen Rhodes. Of course, we will be organizing to make sure that there's some input in that plan. But Tom, I must say, unfortunately, we've seen the Snyder administration dominate the court system, dominate the state legislature, dominate, obviously, the governor's mansion. And so really there's only one branch of government in Michigan right now, and it's the Snyder branch of government. And so unless the federal government comes in, the attorney general's office comes in, or we get this case fast-tracked to the U.S. Supreme Court, unfortunately it seems like this train may have left the station.
Well, and even if it gets to the Supreme Court, you got five crazy right-wingers on the court.
Indeed.
So this is a tough one. I'm going to be doing a daily take about this tonight on my TV show, and you're going to be on our TV show too. And basically what I'm saying is that all of the news networks, everybody's talking about the bankruptcy in Detroit. Nobody's talking about the fact that this was caused by the deindustrialization of America, which was stupid trade policy started under Reagan, and deregulating the banks, which was stupid economic policy started under Reagan. I'm making that very political. I know you probably don't want to do that. So I'm not going to ask you to comment on it. In fact, we're out of time. But we need to be talking, I think, about what brought this about as much as about what's going on, too. Reverend D. Alexander Bullock, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It is always an honor, sir, to have you on this program. You are doing such great work. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at solarworld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Boy, you know, as I just want to, through this hour, instead of doing this daily take here, I've got a story to tell you about porn. Porn stories always go well, right? This is fascinating. I mean, this is absolutely fascinating. And I want to play some more Obama clips. We have a bunch of Obama clips, don't we, Shane? Oh, we've got a pile of them. Okay. And I want to continue a rant that I've been getting into before Reverend Bullock came on. And I was going to, at the end of every segment, we have that guy who comes on and says, "You're listening to Tom Hartmann." And then I have 10 seconds to talk. And I was going to thank the Reverend and give his website again. It's actioncac.org is the website. And Action, and on Facebook, Facebook/ActionCAC, and please drop by and say hi to him for us and see how you know what you can do to pitch in and help out, because he's doing great work there in Detroit. But at the end of the show, there is no little 10-second bump for me to come in and do that tease for the next segment, and I forgot that it was the end of the show, and that's just how dingy my brain is today. Because I was out last night, we had a wonderful book signing here in Washington, D.C., Politics and Prose. It was totally slammed. Shano and Danielle showed up. Jim and his wife showed up, Robin. The people from the TV side all showed up. And I don't know how many people showed up. I don't know what the count was, but it was standing room only. It was lots and lots of people. It was maybe hundreds. I don't, you know, yeah. A lot of people anyway. Joe Madison showed up. In fact, I just kind of yelled at him on the microphone. I didn't get a chance to get over and say hi to him and see him. Joe is not just a friend, but he's also one of my heroes. He has been fighting. He's a brilliant talk radio host. If you've never listened to the Joe Madison show, he's exclusively now, I think, on Sirius XM. Although maybe you can hear it on the internet or whatever, but if you've never listened to his show, you've missed a lot. And he's also been at the forefront of the civil rights movement for most of his life. But he's really a talk radio guy, and one of the best in the business. Anyway, we were talking as I was, and it was nice to see Joe last night. And then Ellen Ratner was there, and Ellen brought wine and cheese and sandwiches and cookies and filled the table. And she put a big sign up that said, "Congratulations, Dr. Hartmann, on your PhD," which was a little bit embarrassing, but, you know, kind of cool. And so, and I've got, you know, and Shane and Danielle got me this Dr. Tom Hartmann thing here that I proudly display on my desk. So yeah, we had a great time last night, and afterwards went out to dinner with Blanquita Cullum, who is Ellen's roommate and is a conservative talk show host, who I've known for years and years, and she's a good friend, and Ellen and Ann Gaiman, who is a medium, who was discussed yesterday. She co-authored a book with Ellen. And another friend of Ellen's who works with her, Sharon. I'm forgetting Sharon's last name. I'm sorry. And so Louise and I sat up until the wee hours in some odd restaurant. So much for my 500 calorie day yesterday. They had, they called them truffles. They were actually French fries with Parmesan cheese on them. And they had a gluten-free lasagna made with corn stuff, made with polenta instead of wheat. And phew. So today I've had a half a banana and a half a glass of orange juice. Although I'm not sure about the content of that orange juice. I might be in trouble today too. Anyway. So as we were saying before the break, before I started describing how brain dead I am, and thank you for tolerating that. The three people now have mentioned trickle down. Reagan has been dead for a while. He hasn't mentioned it recently, but he was all about it, started it, trickle-down economics. But two other people, the Pope and the President, have mentioned trickle-down economics, and the President this morning referenced trickle-down economics as being kind of right around that time in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, when the conventional wisdom, it wasn't just Jimmy Carter. I mean, it was conventional wisdom. It was Congress, the thinking class, the chattering class, conventional wisdom, embraced the idea that Maggie Thatcher and her Chicago School economics and von Mises and all this stuff, that there was something to this. You know, this middle class thing had just gotten out of control. You know, look at these miners making money at mining coal. I mean, come on, that's dirty work. Those people shouldn't be middle class. And so Maggie Thatcher busted the miners' union, and Reagan came in and busted PATCO and installed the first anti-labor head of the Department of Labor ever in the history of the Republic. But anyhow, the Pope last week, in his apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, of the Holy Father Francis, said, some people continue to defend trickle-down theories, which assume that economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts. Now just think for a minute. The Pope, arguably the most, I was going to say the most infallible guy in the world, but, you know, he's in I'm not Catholic, so I can feel free, I suppose, to say he's just as fallible as anybody else. But because of his reputation for infallibility, and if he sits in a particular chair in a particular way and speaks, I think, ex cathedra or whatever it's called, you know, in the voice of God, he actually is considered infallible. Therefore, he's got to be really, really careful that what he says he can back up, right? I mean, you know, Joe Barton can make some crazy-ass rant about, you know, the congressman from Texas about how, you know, God's up there in the sky taking care of us, and don't worry, there ain't no such thing as global warming, because the Lord's going to end the world. It ain't going to be us, right? But the Pope can't do that. If he says something, particularly if he says it in the official Evangelii Gaudium, the apostolic exhortation of the Holy Father Francis to the bishops, clergy, consecrated persons, and lay faithful, the proclamation of the gospel today, especially if he says it in that context, you could pretty much take it to the bank, regardless of what you think about religion or Catholicism. In other words, take this stuff seriously. It ain't just me saying it, it's the Pope. Some people continue to defend trickle-down theories, which assume the economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system. She then goes on to take apart. So here you have the Pope condemning trickle-down economics. You have the President condemning trickle-down economics. At the same time that Bernie Sanders, who is kind of leading the poll for president right now, we talked about this yesterday, pretty amazing, that Bernie Sanders is sitting in a room with Paul Ryan trying to work out a budget. Now, you don't, I doubt the Pope is trying to lobby Paul Ryan. But I don't doubt that the president's speech today had something to do with that conference committee that's going on and giving Bernie a, hey, I got your back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive. I'm becoming more and more optimistic. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rich, watching Free Speech TV in Jefferson City, Missouri. Hey, Rich, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Fine. You say that you disagree with me that Jimmy Carter wasn't a union buster.
No, he was a union buster.
How so?
Well, when he did the deregulation, the first effect it had was every major city in the United States had a street, like St. Louis had Hall Street, which my dad worked, was a Teamster. Mm-hmm. And on that, you know, you had a lot of small companies. And when he first did it, all those companies started consolidating, turning into one big company. And Hall Street and streets in Kansas City and Philadelphia, they all started closing down. And there's no longer, and they were all union jobs. They were dock workers and truck drivers and whatnot.
Right.
And then the secondary effect was that was where you started seeing businesses move out of major cities where you had strong unions. And going to small towns where they could, they didn't have to worry about unions.
Yeah. What you're describing, my recollection of what you're describing, Jimmy Carter did deregulate the transportation industry. He did deregulate the dock workers. And that, the dock workers union, the longshoremen, took a hit on that. And
so did all the small, like the Teamsters had a bunch of dock workers at
sure.
the time.
Yeah. There were a bunch of unions who were involved in that. I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you, but Carter was doing it because he thought it would be a good thing for the country. Reagan was doing it because he hated the unions because he knew that they voted Democratic and he wanted to get rid of them.
I don't agree with that philosophy. I think they're all pretty much anti-union, but there was a lot.
But the unions supported the Democrats.
That had a lot of effect. I know the unions were. The unions supported Clinton and. I mean, you can go down the line.
Yeah, look what he did with NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA. Yeah.
Yeah, there's always betrayal, but what I'm saying is I think we glorify and mythifies these people, and they're really not.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things if we stop and look and evaluate their presidency, we could see that it wasn't, as glorious as what we make it out to be.
Sure.
I just.
Sure. And it wasn't necessarily as evil as we make it out to be either. I mean, a lot of the things that I blame Ronald Reagan for are not things that I think he sat down and said, oh, I'm going to really screw these people. I think, they just thought it was the best thing at the time.
You could make the point that Obama is right of Ronald Reagan on a lot of policies, economic policy.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. And the benefit of all this, Rich, is that now we've had 32 years of this experiment, or 34 years if you include the last 2 years of the Carter administration. And we can see what it's done to this country. And I think that the president's speech today, in a large way, although he still hasn't figured out the trade piece of it, or he's in the pocket of the big transnational corporations and the banksters, or both, but he's starting to talk like, it's time to undo those mistakes of those last Carter years and those early Reagan years.
It may be a swan song, but I'm not as optimistic as you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, the title of my book is The Crash of 2016. I'm not a total optimist, right? But
you wrote a great book called Injustice, Unequal Protection.
Yes. Thank you.
You show the target that is a great book, by the way. But
thank you.
You show that companies will use a target.
Yeah,
it's a whole other rhetoric.
Yeah, it is, and we're out of time. The machine has started. So, Rich, thank you for your call. Thoughtful point, excellent point. Thank you. We'll be right back. I made a comment yesterday, in passing and joking. I was talking about. In fact, here's the article right here. This article that was on Democratic Underground, titled, It's Not the Morphine, It's the Size of the Cage, Rat Park Experiments Upturns Conventional Wisdom. And there's a clothing ad on there because I have bought clothing on the internet, and there's an ad for Decon rat killers, because I'm assuming, because the article was about rats, so they figured I had an interest in rats. And I made the joke, boy, it's, you know, because I, you can kind of pretty much these days walk over and look over anybody's shoulder at their computer and know what they're browsing by simply looking at the ads on the New York Times or on Democratic Underground or whatever, because they're at, you know, the ads reflect your cookie browsing. And I made the joke. I said, boy, it's a good thing I haven't been browsing porn on the internet. This is a front page story in today's Financial Times. And I find this troubling and interesting. And I think that the thing that's most interesting about it, and that's probably the, actually the least troubling about it, is that a lot of people will say, oh, I got nothing to hide. You know, I don't care if they, you know, I kind of like the fact that when I go to Amazon.com, they know that I like fountain pens instead of ballpoint pens, so they show me ads for fountain pens or whatever it may be. You know, by the way, I actually prefer those little skinny felt tip ones, but whatever. You get my point. Some people like the fact that they're being tracked and that the cookie and that they're constantly seeing ads for the kinds of things that they might want to buy, and that when they go to shopping sites, they get the recommended, the, you know, go to the vitamin website that you normally buy your vitamins from, and sure enough, there's your vitamin C or your CoQ10 or whatever it may be. But here's the headline. Visits to porn sites tracked by hundreds of companies. Hundreds of companies. Now, I can understand where a porn company, and keep in mind, you know, about a third of all the traffic on the internet, I've seen statistics as low as 10%, as high as 50%. But I think the most reliable numbers are somewhere between 20 and 30% of all the traffic on the internet is porn. People watching porn. Or downloading porn. Or I guess for some people, uploading porn. Okay. So you can see where the companies who are involved in this might want to keep track of it. But this is a whole different thing. Emily Steele wrote this in New York City for the Financial Times. Nearly 900 million internet users. Now, there's probably only about 200 million internet users in the United States. So this is like, this is worldwide. Nearly 900 million, almost a billion internet users were tracked by hundreds of third-party internet and advertising companies when they visited pornographic sites this summer, according to Ghostery, a company that monitors online tracking. The tracking details can include information about the URL of the site, how long a person stays on the site, and how many clicks they make there. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. You would think that, you know, sexyvideos.com or whatever, you know, just to make up the name, it probably exists. If you could think of it, it probably exists. But whatever, you'd think that some, you know, porn site would want to know if you were somebody who liked to watch porn. But your credit card company might deny you a credit card because you watch porn. Listen to this. Privacy advocates fear the details about visits to adult-oriented sites could be incorporated into the vast dossiers of that internet advertising and data companies create about individuals and are used to tailor ads and content other people see, among other purposes. Porn sites are estimated to make up at least 15% of the internet. A credit card company, for instance, could choose not to target ads to a person who frequently visits porn sites, judging them to be a higher-risk customer. A gambling operation, meanwhile, could target ads to people who spend more hours visiting adult sites, considering them to have more addictive tendencies. While some companies said that browsing behavior from adult-oriented sites is not used to determine what ads people see, several internet and advertising companies' privacy policies, do not explicitly bar the practice. Now, where it gets really interesting to me is, it says, pornography dominates the web. About a quarter of online searches, 68 million a day, are for porn. Those sites increasingly are relying on advertising to make money. 85% are advertising supported. It's fascinating stuff. But this, you know, the news comes after regulations. The U.S. National Security Agency tracked the visits to porn sites of six Muslims so that that information that they had visited porn sites could be used to harm their reputations. According to a document provided to the Huffington Post by Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower. So, I guess the good news here is that a lot of the people who make policy tend to be white men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, who I'm guessing, especially Republicans, and I'm saying that not facetiously, we know that the state of Utah, on a per capita basis, more porn is sold in the state of Utah than any other state. I remember that from a year ago. There was a study that came out on that. And it was old white guys. Old Mormon white guys, mostly. So could it be that those guys are going to start going, oh, wait a minute. You know, maybe there is something to this internet privacy thing. Maybe we should put some limits on, you know, what these companies are tracking and how they're watching everything we do. And maybe Ed Snowden is right. And because of porn, I mean, it's because of porn that so much good video is happening on the internet. Porn sites develop a lot of the technology. Because of porn, we might get some internet privacy. What do you think?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I don't know if you want to call with an opinion on that or not. And I'm still not sure if it's good news or bad news, but I find it fascinating. We'll be back. Welcome back, and it's the good, the bad, and the very, very kyphotically ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, Jim Yong Kim. Today, the president of the World Bank announced, that's Jim Yong Kim, announced a new initiative to provide billions of dollars in energy aid to developing nations. And while the organization's plan includes funds for the usual energy sources like geothermal, wind and solar, is one type of energy that is not on that list: nuclear. President Kim made a special effort to point out to the press that the World Bank doesn't do nuclear. And while Kim's decision was ultimately a political one, it's still a welcome sign that an organization as powerful as the World Bank is putting nuclear energy on the back burner. Whatever way you put it, nuclear energy is a bad deal. Good on President Kim for trying to work towards a world without nukes. The bad. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. Not everyone is so keen on green energy. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, has a new piece of model legislation punishing solar panel users. Seriously. According to leaked documents, the right-wing group wants power companies to cut back on the amount of money they reimburse solar panel users for the energy that those solar panels produce, as well as the energy they pump back into the power grid. Alex says this is to prevent solar panel users from getting a free ride. But let's be honest, this is really about protecting the organization's oil industry donors. If Alex really wanted to stop people from getting free rides, they could start by speaking out against the oil industry's gift-wrapped tax breaks. And the very, very ugly, Amy Lacey. The principal of Hempstead Independent School District in Texas has been placed on leave for telling Latino students that they were no longer able to speak Spanish at school because doing so was disruptive. Some of those Latino students told their story to local news.
These four students say their principal's attempt to ban them from speaking Spanish in class has given teachers and fellow students a hall pass to discriminate.
She's like, no speak Spanish. She told me like that. I was like, that's my first language. She's like, well, you can get out.
People don't want to speak it no more and don't want to get caught speaking it because they're going to get in trouble.
Wow. Nothing says keeping students like making a 14-year-old feel like a criminal for speaking her native language, right? That's just very, very ugly. It's one of the great regrets of my life. I have a long list of regrets in my life, but one of the things that I wish had been different in my parents, in my dad's life, was that his mom and dad came here from Norway and they spoke Norwegian, and I used to sit around and they would speak Norwegian because they knew that I didn't have a clue what they were saying. And they would not let my father learn Norwegian because they wanted him to be an American. And I wish they had taught him Norwegian, and I wish he had taught me Norwegian. I would love to have been a bilingual child. We need to be encouraging bilingualism. When people learn more than one language, when they learn a second language before the age of 7, the brain actually physically develops differently. Broca's region, the part of the brain that processes language, actually grows and expands, and it makes it easier to learn third and fourth and fifth and sixth languages, multiple languages, and it enhances language comprehension, it increases intellect and IQ. Bilingual people are actually at an advantage, not a disadvantage. And here you got this school in Texas saying to these bilingual kids, how dare you be bilingual? You can't do that in our class. I mean, come on. Do you really mean to do that? So anyhow, I've been ranting here now for an hour and a half, pretty much nonstop. We still have a whole bunch of Obama clips I want to play, but I noticed that, we've got 12 phone lines coming into here, and every single one of them is lit up. So let's see what y'all want to talk about today as well. Todd in Anoka, Minnesota. Hey, Todd, thanks for listening to AM 950. What's on your mind?
Thanks, Tom. We look forward to seeing you up here at the Blue State Ball next month.
I don't think I'm going to make the Blue State Ball.
I thought you were listed as one of the guests.
I'll have to double check. I'd have to check with my wife because she keeps my schedule. I'm sorry, but I think my book signing there last week or the week before last was my gig. But in any case, the Blue State Ball is a hoot, and whether I'm there or not, everybody should show up in the Minneapolis St. Paul area. It's incredible.
Well, it'll be unfortunate if you're not there, but
yeah.
I was calling to try to tie together the very first segment you had where your guest seemed to me to be blaming the financial collapse and the housing market on the poor,
right,
with your really prescient comments about trickle-down. And it seemed to me that when interest rates were so extremely low in the early and mid-2000s, it was kind of the attempt of some to give trickle down to those people at the lower end of the economic scale.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as you said during your comments, that the banks were out hustling, I think is the word you use. And
yep.
that is so accurate, because if you look at what was going on at that time, they all want to blame it on people of lower incomes who didn't understand the loans they were taking out. But you had banks like, for example, WaMu, Washington Mutual on the West Coast, that eventually collapsed, that in their internal documents, they had a very aggressive effort to do things like no doc loans, no documentation when people
right.
came in to apply for mortgages, or stated income loans where the applicant simply had to state their income and no one at the bank would do any kind of a check to find out whether that.
Well, and in fact, what we've learned in the years since then is in many of those stated income loans, the question was never asked, what is your income? Instead, after the person, that line was left blank, the person signed a mortgage document that had a lot of blanks on it, and after that person left, the mortgage broker, the person who was making a commission on selling that mortgage, filled in the stated amount.
Yes. It was fraud. And those people, like the guests, want to blame it on the people whose ultimately their mortgages collapsed, when
yeah.
in fact what it was the hustling of the banks trying to expand their position in that red hot market so they
yep.
could get as many of those loans bundled together and sold off to a third party, which ultimately collapsed.
Yeah.
That really brought it about. And one more point, if I may, is that during that time we bought a home in 2007. So we were
mm-hmm.
right at the real height of that market.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the state of Minnesota where we live, the typical closing on the home, ours was scheduled at 9 o'clock in the morning. We showed up at the title company at 9 a.m. And we were presented with 38 pages, legal size of documents that we had never seen before 9 o'clock that morning. And we were expected to be finished with the closing by 10 o'clock, 60 minutes later.
Right.
So does that mean that I'm supposed to read those 38 pages of legal documents in less than 60 minutes, understand them all, and be able to competently sign and understand that loan? Of course not. It's impossible for anyone to be presented with documents 38 pages in length.
I've made the comment that the one time that I actually read my mortgage documents was back in the 80s. We bought a house in Roswell, Georgia. And I actually said, okay, damn it, I'm going to read this thing, because I got it a day or so in advance, unlike your situation. And as I'm reading it, there's a line that says, I hereby give up my rights under the 13th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution, or whatever. It was under two amendments of the Constitution, or two Constitution, you know, I give up my constitutional rights. I forget which ones they were. And I took it back to the bank, and I said, I'm not going to sign this. And the guy said, then you're not going to get the mortgage. And it was right there in the mortgage documents that I was giving up my constitutional rights. It was mind-boggling.
The same thing happened during my closing, as I tried to scan these documents quickly, and in one of them I found, and this was a federal document that said that I had to allow my mortgage company access to my income tax statements for in perpetuity. They were allowed to, even though they were saying at this moment I qualified for the loan. This document said that forevermore they had access to my tax statements to determine where I stood, I guess, financially, even though they were already decided that I was competent for the loan. And when I objected to that document, I got the very same comment you did, and that was, I'm sorry, but the process stops now if you don't sign that document.
Right, take it or leave it. In fact, now that I think back, I think that I was giving up my Sixth and Seventh Amendment rights to the Constitution, which are basically the right for a jury trial, in exchange for arbitration.
Guess, again, back to your point from earlier, is that and your first guess, it didn't fall on that.
And I got to tell you, during that time, you know, that I was doing a local show in Portland, and there was a mortgage company that I was reading ads for in 2005 and 2006. And when the housing market started falling apart in late 2006, early 2007, I went to management and said, I won't read these ads anymore. And this was a year before the crash, but I was on the air saying, I think this is a bad idea. This housing market is going bad. The stock market's going to go bad. You know, get into cash. This is not the time to be refi. And it's just, you know, I got a lot of abuse for that from that radio station. But I'll tell you, sometimes you just have to say it. Todd, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to AM 950. And you will have a wonderful time at the Blue State Ball, whether I'm there or not. And I may be. I'm not, like I said, I'm not sure. So, Ed Schultz and Stephanie Miller are definitely going to be there. So that should be a lot of fun. 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Ed Schultz and Stephanie Miller, it's like a study in contrasts. You know, kind of big and small, and it's amazing. Welcome back 15 minutes before the hour. Judy in Bailey, Colorado. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Hi. Yesterday I was listening to Ed Schultz, and he said that with the Michigan, the Detroit bankruptcy, that they went immediately to bankruptcy. They haven't tried anything else. And that the governor has not allowed any of the tax money to go to Detroit. So
that's right.
They can't pay their bills because they're not getting any of their tax money that they put into the coffers.
That's right. There's another piece to it, too, and this is that the banksters have been refusing to foreclose on the homes that they're sitting on, these bad mortgages. And the reason that they're not foreclosing, although they are kicking people out, is because when you foreclose, you have to pay the property taxes. So there's millions and millions of dollars in property taxes that are owed to the city of Detroit by banks which have reclaimed possession of houses from people who have not been able to pay, but they have not yet done the legal process that would force them to pay their property taxes. So the banks are screwing the city too, for lack of a better phrase.
Oh yeah, and we're expected to do everything else for them. And you know, I'm a leftist. Obama's speeches are great, but then you look at what he does afterwards, and it's totally opposite of what he claims he wants to do.
Well, no, it's not totally opposite. It's 10 or 20% opposite. I mean, let's cut the guy a little bit of slack here. He has called for an increase in the minimum wage. He's called for a lot of good things. It's just getting anything through. And I'm not trying to. I'm genuinely not trying to be an Obama apologist. I disagree with the great man theory of history. I completely disagree with it. Franklin Roosevelt was a corrupt governor of the most corrupt state in the United States, and yet he became one of America's greatest presidents. It wasn't because he was a great man. Franklin Roosevelt became one of America's greatest presidents because the times demanded it and because the people demanded it. And frankly, I think with President Obama, what you're seeing is a reflection of the times and the people. And the people aren't demanding it yet.
They're speaking out somewhat that we need really the poor and the working poor to really speak out more and to stand up.
And they're starting to.
They're starting to. And I've talked to many
people. President Obama's talking about them. Do you think Mitt Romney would be?
Oh, God, no. No. Yeah. And I have a real problem with the right, but the Democrats are also supporting the right and letting them get away with this by not saying anything. And the other issue is women. I wish progressives would be as angry about what is happening to women in this country as they have been about guns.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But there's no talk.
Yeah.
Even your show, you may bring it up once a month, but that's it.
Okay, I'm sorry, I missed a sentence there. Ellen Ratner just walked in and sat down. What's the it that I missed?
Women in this country are being totally ignored. We're looking at, how can I say this nicely? Guns were ranted on for days and weeks and months,
right.
And yet what's happening to women, Texas has been forcing women who want abortions to have transvaginal ultrasound.
I got it, Judy. I'm sorry, we're out of time. You're absolutely right. Thank you. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and in fact, a much better one is Ellen Ratner is in the studio with us. A much better one that I'm in is called I Am by
that
Tom Shady. You have that?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
That
so anyway, so
Tom's in a great bunch of movies, and I just want to tell everybody, if you didn't live in Washington, D.C. and didn't make it to Tom Hartman's book party and his Becoming Dr. Tom Hartman party, you missed a good one, but we'll do it again.
And, well, thank you, Ellen. And it was so kind of you to sponsor the event last night. And
we're
going to
do it. Well, Tom's got some new books coming out after this, and so it's always an excuse for a fun party.
There you go.
Where's our Dr. Tom Hartman sign?
It's, I don't know. I don't know, but I've got this.
Oh, well, I know, but we will get the big sign for you.
Okay, all right. I should mention the Talk Radio News Service is brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. The old goat sitting right here in the studio with me. Proudly waving her hand, and I'm one too, I suppose. And giving a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan, goatsfortheoldgoat.com is the only animal group that gives you a picture of your goat and the recipient, and that picture is taken in. Is it always by you, Ellen? I mean, you're most of the time.
We do 4 trips a year, and sometimes there's a 5th trip. So if there's a 5th trip, then Franco or Joel take the pictures. But it's always one of our American staff members.
Great. So this is like, you know, this is just the little charity that could. So anyhow, the
okay.
news.
Oh my gosh. So I think I want to start out with the kind of good news. Sometimes I don't, but today the president gave a speech at the Center for American Progress. He said that income inequality was the defining challenge of our time.
Right.
Congratulations, Mr. President. He said the majority of Americans agree that our number one priority is to restore opportunity and broad-based growth for all Americans. And he pointed to what, of course, Bernie Sanders has been talking about, you've been talking about last night when you gave your talk about your book, increasing the minimum wage
right.
and altering the tax code to ensure that jobs stay within the United States.
Right.
Hello.
Yeah, yeah. I would say he's not going to say it, but I think eventually the times are going to get there. When Franklin Roosevelt raised, you know, the tax rate from 25 back up to 91%, Harding had dropped it from 91 down to 25% in 1921. And by 1935, FDR had taken it back up to 95%. Nobody objected. Everybody got it. Banksters have ripped us off 95%. We need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts because that's where this all began. Anyway.
Well, you're not going to get...
An argument from you, I know.
Okay. So also, our friend Daryl Issa had another hearing today. He called the Affordable Care Act a disaster. He bashed the law in general. He said that consumer choice has been reduced and the government has created a monopoly that will only drive up the health care prices. Gee, I thought health care prices just went down.
Yeah, and they have for three years in a row, ever since the Affordable Care Act.
Exactly.
But Daryl Issa is right. The Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, is a disaster for the Republican Party. It's going to bite them in the back.
And I think it's going to bite them in the back, too. So today, also, former Congressman, now Health Insurance Commissioner for the state of Washington, he testified before Congress, and he said he was against allowing the president's health care plan or allowing health insurance companies to continue selling the old policies. He said that over 100,000 people in Washington state have already signed up. There's another 150,000 waiting for their applications to be approved. He thinks that that's secondary care and that it ought to meet the requirements of the law.
Good.
So he was very aggressive about that. Mm-hmm. Now, something very interesting. The House Science Committee, the Senate is pretty much out of
this is the House, so it's run by a Republican.
That's
and it
right.
has the word science in it. Did they have a debate about Darwin? Or?
No, today was actually reasonable. They had a PhD from MIT talking about extraterrestrial life. She says that if one in five sun-like stars have an Earth and every Earth has a life, we will discover life somewhere else. It may only be on a microbe level at this point, but within 10 years, she believes we are going to discover life elsewhere.
I don't disagree.
I don't either, and I thought that was pretty amazing that they had this. And actually, Lamar Smith, a Republican from Texas, said that this was going to be inevitable to discover life elsewhere.
Wow.
Pretty amazing. Senator Stabenow and the House negotiator, Congressman Frank Lucas, said that they are coming closer
this
on
is the
farm bill.
This is
the conference on the farm bill.
Okay.
It looks like the corn lobby and the soybean lobby are the ones that are sort of the sticky wickets here, as my eighth grade math teacher used to say. But it looks like they are coming more to agreement.
Good.
Department of Defense says that over the next 10 years, whether there is a sequestration or not, they want to cut $1 billion worth. That's about 100. Did I say a billion? Yeah, I think that's a billion over 10 years. That's $100 million a year in personnel. They said that it is time for the Pentagon to get a little more lean and mean and be able to make significant reductions in civilian personnel. And they are also going to do this through contractor reductions. They said that
the
military
do
does not need it.
Yeah. And let us not forget the most famous military contractor, of the last decade or so, Ed Snowden.
Right. Yes. He's hoping
so they're
to.
Like, let's not hire any more of these.
He said that the Department of Defense is going to take difficult but necessary choices to remain ahead in terms of compensation reform, acquisitions, and other parts of the Department
That's
of
good.
Defense.
That's good.
Okay. Last but not least, the vice president is in China. He is meeting with the premier of China. They met for 5.5 hours, some just together with a small group of staff and translators, some in a larger situation. They spent a lot of time on the need to build trust and all of that. They spent a lot more time on North Korea. They took a look at that situation in view of the news reports and making North Korea, of course, not have a nuclear weapon. I think they're all agreed on that. Then they talked about that interdiction zone on the island.
It's the airspace zone.
That's a big one. And they also talked about the World Trade Organization. They talked about silver dumping, which dumping means to sell stuff at below market value.
Right.
They apparently talked quite a bit about all of that.
Wow, fascinating stuff. But no specific resolutions, any of them.
Not that we've heard.
It's a beginning. Ellen Radner, Talk Radio News Service, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jonathan Mosley, who is the button over here, put him on the air. Jonathan is the is a talk show host with Conservative Commandos Radio, Tea Party activist, a criminal defense attorney. His website, curesocialism.blogspot.com. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I understand that you recently said that if Jesus were aware of, and or presumably he is, what Pope Francis is saying about how trickle-down economics is not supported by facts and is a bad thing, basically, that Jesus would be weeping. Do I have that right?
Well, specifically, that socialism has caused, in my view, depending on what you determine it to be, has caused poverty, and for that reason, I don't think he'd be happy about more of it.
Why is it then that the democratic socialist countries of the world are the richest countries?
Well, I don't.
They have the lowest poverty rates. Lowest poverty rates in the world. Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Germany, France. Lowest poverty rates in the world in the democratic socialist countries.
Well, I think the United States, other than the fact that we've run ourselves into debt.
We have one of the worst poverty rates in the world since Reaganomics. We were pretty good before 1980. We were in the top five or six, but we're now,
well, I think,
out of 34 countries, we're number 34.
The economic boom in American history, and doubled our tax revenue. But the thing is that this is what
I know. Reagan doubled taxes on working people. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I don't think he did.
Well, actually, he did. Go back and look in 1982. Actually, he literally doubled taxes on anybody who made at that time under $70,000 a year.
I think he'd cut taxes on everybody. But
nope.
But the thing is that socialism requires force. It requires government violence to make people conform, whereas capitalism, as I interpret it, is freedom and individual free will, which is what Christianity depends upon.
Okay. So you start out I'd love to get into those definitions, and perhaps hopefully we'll have time. You start out with this quote from Luke chapter 12. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." And he said to him, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And then you say, in just one verse, we see that God rejects the left-wing, Jesus Christ-supported socialism heresy. I'm guessing that you didn't read all of Luke chapter 12, because five lines later, God is speaking to this guy and says, "But God said unto them, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou have you provided?" So it is with those who lay up treasures for themselves. Such people are not rich toward God.
Yes, because Jesus spoke to the individual of his responsibility to do, how to live with his own life.
Right.
But he didn't say take it from one person to give it to another. And that's what I define socialism as. Should a person beware of the lure of wealth and be generous to others? Absolutely. We have Christmas coming up. Sure, people should give to the poor. But Jesus didn't go grab the person and have his people, you know, pull, you know, pick his pocket.
But he was not. Not only was he not a capitalist, but he said, remember when the rich guy came to him? It's in Matthew. I can't just quote chapter and verse anymore. I used to be able to, actually. Where the rich guy comes to him and says, how do I get into heaven? And he says, sell everything you own and give it to the poor and then join me. I mean, here he is saying to a capitalist, stop being a capitalist and you can go to heaven. You're trying to tell me Jesus is a capitalist?
Yeah, I mean, Jesus was a carpenter. He ran a small business. Peter was
Jesus was a preacher. Maybe, you know, when he was young. But, you know, what we know of his life, there's no reference to that in the Bible. The Bible refers to him as basically a rabbi. He was a wandering minister.
But he was a carpenter. He ran his own business. He did carpentry.
Where in the Bible does it say that?
Which is kind of high-end in terms of the building.
Where in the Bible does it say that?
I'd have to go look it up, but the thing is that
I just don't recall any reference to Jesus running his own business, you know, buying nails, hiring people, firing people, you know, having a bank account, storing up cash for a rainy day. I don't see it there. What I see is Jesus saying to rich people, you guys are screwed. You know, a camel will go through the eye of a needle easier than you're going to get to heaven.
But he did say that. But where do you get from that to government involvement? How does that relate to the government?
Well, I don't think Jesus talked about government involvement. You know, the guy came to him with a coin and said, should I pay my taxes? And Jesus said, whose picture is on that? And the guy said, Julius Caesar. And Jesus said, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar and unto God what is God. In other words, pay your taxes. So, I think if you want to make an argument, that's the only reference that I recall in the entire Bible, and I've read it four times from Genesis to Revelation and used to preach it. That's the only time I recall Jesus referring specifically to taxes and government in the first person with one single individual. And basically what he was saying was, pay your taxes. So I would say he was being supportive of socialism because the Romans at that time were actually supporting poor people.
Well, he was saying don't break the law. Those taxes were also paid.
No, this guy wasn't asking about the law. This guy was asking about paying taxes.
Yeah, which was the law, but they also used that money to invade other countries, rape and kill people and destroy whole countries.
And Jesus said, pay your taxes. Now, he did. You can, you know, if you want to take Elaine Pagel's interpretation and that of many good Christian scholars, Jesus did argue that people should break the law. You know, there were Roman laws that said that, you know, people wiped their butts with their left hand, and so the left hand was considered unclean. So you could hit a person in the face with your right hand legally, but you could not legally hit them with your left hand. It was against the law. And so Jesus said, if somebody strikes you on the left cheek, turn the right cheek to them. In other words, if they hit you with their right hand, then basically force them to hit you with your left hand. Force them to break the law. They can lose their Roman citizenship over that. Same thing with the walk the second mile. There were anti-exploitation laws that said that Romans could have the occupied people carry things for up to 1 mile, but more than that was considered exploitation. You could lose your Roman citizenship and go to jail. Jesus said, if somebody makes you carry something for a mile, carry it a second mile. You carry it the second mile, that you're putting that person into jail. Same thing with the toga and robe thing. We're running out of time. I don't want to turn this into a Bible study, but I don't see any. I don't see how you could say that Jesus was not anything other than the original socialist.
But the thing is, the rich young ruler didn't sell all he owned, and nobody, you know, he didn't sick his band on him to beat him up and steal it. He told him to sell everything he owned. He didn't do it, and
right.
Jesus just walked away.
Right.
He didn't force people to comply. He said every individual what they ought to do, but he didn't advocate one person forcing them.
So your conception of freedom is where there is absolutely no force. So this is a total libertarian argument. You're suggesting then that we should not have public roads because somebody has to pay for that, which is going to require force. That we should not have public schools, that we should not have public libraries, that we should not have, you know, pretty much anything. You want us to just go back to the jungle?
No, I wouldn't take it to that total version. You had at the news somebody ripping off somebody else's picture and selling it at Walmart. That should be illegal. That's stealing. That's that's fraud. I think that there have to be laws so that people are making voluntary choices when they purchase things.
Then you're a socialist.
No, I don't think that laws requiring honesty are the same thing.
But I'm talking about public infrastructure. How do we get public infrastructure without taxes? Taxes require, you know, guys with guns coming and getting money from you. How do you do that? Or are you saying that there should be no taxes and therefore there should be no public infrastructure?
No, I don't think that charity comes by taking it from one person.
Do you think there should be any public infrastructure whatsoever? Should we have public roads?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, then you're a socialist. By your own definition.
That's an expenditure of government. It's not stealing from one person to give to another. And I don't think...
How is it not? I don't own a car. I don't use the roads. I use the metro system here in Washington, D.C., and I pay every time I use it. And yet my tax dollars are going to pay for the roads.
If you take a taxi to the airport, you might use the roads. But that's
well, they're building a subway out there, actually, right now. Jonathan Mosley, I hope to continue this conversation with you some other time. It's
right.
Been a great conversation. His website, curesocialism.blogspot.com. Jonathan, thanks for dropping by.
Merry Christmas. Bye.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy holidays to everybody else. And happy Flying Spaghetti Monster and everything. We'll be right. Happy Pasta Primavera. It's Pasta Primavera Day. Well, you know, spaghetti typically is red, and Primavera is green. And so if you had the Flying Spaghetti Monster, and on one side he had pesto sauce, and on the other side he had marinara sauce, you'd have a Christmas Flying Spaghetti Monster. I think we've added to the religion. My goodness. Amazing. Amazing the things you learn, right, as they say. Jeff in Foley, Alabama. Hey, Jeff. What's on your mind today?
Yeah,
thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me. I had one comment I wanted to make, but sitting here listening, I actually got two more I want to add to that.
Okay.
The first one was the discussion about the Spanish-speaking children.
Mm-hmm.
I was born and raised in an area where children spoke two languages, mm-hmm. where one language was first for some. And one language was just the English language.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot even begin to imagine if you did not experience. I appreciate how you put it about listening to your grandparents speak Norwegian,
mm-hmm.
because I listened to my grandparents speak Cajun and didn't learn it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But I had children in my classroom that when they raised their hand and were called on, instead of their response being in English, it came out naturally in Cajun.
Right.
And it was mass confusion.
Right. But that's not what the school is objecting
that's
to.
That's exactly what she said. She said, she asked the children not to speak it in class because it was causing confusion.
To each other, not to her.
To each other, right. Between the people that spoke only American and the children that spoke Spanish and American. And the Spanish children said, well, that's my first language. Well, the American's children... their first language is English.
Yeah. What we're really talking about here, Jeff,
what
we're really talking about here, and let's just be honest about this, what we're really talking about is in-crowd and out-crowd. It's that the kids who speak Spanish can say to each other things that the kids who don't speak Spanish don't understand, and the kids who don't speak Spanish, who only speak English, are upset about that.
Did you go through the school? Did you have a personal experience with it?
I read the article about it. I read the interview. I saw the video.
Did you go through it personally in your life?
Well, I don't understand your point. Aren't I saying the same thing you're saying? Aren't we agreeing? Aren't we agreeing here, Jeff?
As a child, it is very confusing, man. That's what I'm trying to explain to you.
No, I think it goes beyond confusing. I agree with you. If an English speaking teacher says, what is 2 + 2? And a Spanish speaking child stands up and says cinco, which I think is 4 in Spanish.
And an American doesn't know what cinco means. What they gonna say?
Then you got a problem. I agree with you.
That's right.
I agree with you. But I don't think that's what was going on. What was going, if you read the news article and you look at the interview that was done with these kids, what the teacher was saying is don't talk among each other in Spanish because it's upsetting the kids who don't speak Spanish. And that's in club, out club stuff.
Let me take it there.
And I think that's just human nature.
as an English-speaking child, I'm standing on the playground, and three Cajun kids are standing over there talking and Cajun, and I don't understand them.
I understand, and it's upsetting. I got it. But does that mean that the teacher should forbid them from speaking in Cajun?
Yeah, absolutely. It's exactly what they did, brother.
Okay. I see. If I were you, Jeff, I would have tried to learn Cajun. But anyhow, thanks for the call. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And amazing. Jesus was a capitalist. He hated socialism. Oh, well. Brian in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Brian, you wanted to comment on arbitration agreements? Giving up your Sixth and Seventh Amendment rights?
I'm introducing myself as Jonah. I keep doing a double take.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's quite all right.
I forget because part of me thinks it's dishonest when I go somewhere new. I always introduce two names and then forget I did it. Oh. Just habit.
Okay. You can tell Danielle when she answers the phone, and she can fix it in the database, so it always comes up.
Oh, I know it's my fault, because you guys are very nice about that. I'm just, psychologically, I think I'm careful because it's the radio, but I get fixed phrases.
Yeah, no, it's quite all right. We're pleased to call you whatever you'd like. We got, you know, one guy who's like, you know, what was he? Something like, you know, the weed man was calling from Santa Cruz for a while. I mean, you know, it's all good. So anyhow, what's on your mind?
Well, and I'll try to, I'm trying subconsciously not to connect this to what I talked about yesterday, but I see a link between concerns about seeking the opportunity for volition involve being aware that anybody, not just somebody like me flopping around trying to read, is disabled in regards to a contract a judge couldn't read.
Interesting.
Elizabeth, what's her name? What's her last name?
Warren?
Warren, thank you. Said that when I've seen her in interviews on YouTube talking about, although may have predated some changes to to laws in regards to credit cards,
right.
That she taught contract law at Harvard.
That's correct.
I think she said?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
I'm glad she couldn't
understand the contracts for her own credit card or mortgage. Yeah, now I remember seeing that. And I also remember during the Clinton administration when there was actually legislation passed with much hullabaloo about how contracts had to be in plain English. But either that went away or it got narrowed. The two things perked my ears here, Brian, my brain. One, you're suggesting basically, if I get this right, that if somebody is going to have to sign a mortgage contract or any kind of contract, that it should be something that they can read, that it's in plain English, right?
So for people like me, we're struggling. I expect everybody cover, if there's a bank and it's not just MasterCard,
right.
But it's both, I expect that bank with a physical place that I can drive to, even if it's in another state.
Where they will be able to sit down and explain it to you, mean?
That way. What's that?
Where they can sit down and explain it to you?
Or let me get help.
Yeah.
What I've found is, even with some of the, now the new features that seem nice for a while, the dispute options,
mm-hmm.
is that if you're like me and you try to use them and they say you can handle it in person, I most certainly cannot and you weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I can't talk and they didn't help me. Not only that, they broke the law when they did it.
Huh. Okay. Brian, I think volition, which is it was in your first sentence, is a whole another topic that someday I hope we can have a conversation about. But I'm going to move along. But thank you. I think that you're right. I think that contracts should be in plain English, and there should be a requirement that if somebody doesn't understand the contract, that somebody explains it to them. Where this gets really weird is all those contracts that you sign on the internet, where you click and you say I agree to the terms and conditions. And you never click on the terms and conditions and read them. Try it sometime. It's a horrifying experience. Grant in Ventura, California, listening on AM 1150. What's up, Grant?
Hola, Tom. ¿Cómo está?
Está muy bien, gracias. ¿Usted?
Well, you know, as a nurse, I was forced to learn medical Spanish so I could communicate
with
Spanish-speaking people.
Uh-huh.
And What I found is that it was inclusive, and I enjoyed the experience.
Mm-hmm.
I stubbornly went into it, but I ended up enjoying it. First, you know, I want to talk to you about my activism recently.
Okay.
But first, I want to thank you for your excellent book, The Crash of 2016, and your ability to do research and remember American history. I just really appreciated that. And, you know, you're what Aristotle was talking about when he said memory is the scribe of the soul.
Hmm.
So I want to thank you for your book.
Well, thank you. That's
and,
high praise.
Well, you know, I was reading Bernie Sanders' mail, which I get,
mm-hmm.
and in the mail he sent me beautiful excerpts of Pope Francis.
Yes.
And I
got
was
that
so moved
too.
By, I was so moved by what Pope Francis said about the deification of money in our country at the sacrifice of love, compassion, family, humanity. I was so moved by all of that that I wrote a letter to my newspaper and I said, listen, I know you won't print any progressive ideas that I write. I have a conservative newspaper in my community.
Who doesn't?
Anyway,
right.
I said, I know you won't write any, I know you won't put in the press what I write, but I won't let you censor the Pope. So if you continue not to put any words of the Pope in the paper, I'm going to come dressed as the Pope to the newspaper and protest your censorship. And, you know, a funny thing, the very next day, there was a huge article by a columnist who supported the Pope and quoted the Pope directly, some of the very same passages that were that Bernie Sanders distributed.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt my job was done.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
good
it's
on you,
up man. To each of us to speak out, right?
Yes.
Tag, you're it.
Yeah, and that's the great lesson. I mean, that's the ultimate lesson of democracy in a republic or whatever you want to call it. The ultimate lesson of good governance is that we all have to participate. We have to show up. And when we see injustice and in this case it was an injustice by omission rather than commission. When we see injustice, do something about it. That's great guerrilla theater, threatening to dress up as the Pope and show up at the newspaper. I'm really impressed. Grant, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks a lot for watching the program, listening to the program on AM 1150. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, was Jesus a carpenter or not? I thought it was his dad who was the carpenter. Maybe. All right, welcome back. Okay, Ken Collins' website. Did Danielle track this down during the... You tracked it down, Shane. Either you have too much time on your hands or you are just way too smart. Or both. No, it's. I know you don't have too much time on your hands because you work harder than I do. Okay, was Jesus a carpenter? Nowadays, it is quite common to refer to Jesus as a carpenter from Galilee. You might even see people driving around with a bumper sticker that says, my boss is a Jewish carpenter, by which they mean Jesus. But was he a carpenter? The only place where the words Jesus and carpenter occur together in the New Testament is in Mark chapter 6, verses 2 and 3. On the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astounded. They said, where did this man get all this? What is this wisdom that has been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. Now, Ken Collins at kencollins.com points out, you know, there's some interesting aspects to this passage. According to which translation or manuscript you read, some people are asking if he's a carpenter. Others are asking if he is the son of a carpenter. But the point is that he was teaching in a synagogue on the Sabbath. Now, they don't let carpenters preach in synagogues on the Sabbath. It would be like you walking into Jimmy Swaggart's church and saying, Jimmy, get out of the way. I'm going to preach today. It doesn't happen. But the Bible does, the New Testament does call Jesus Rabbi 13 times. Then Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. He didn't say carpenter. Nathaniel says, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. He didn't say carpenter. See, I thought Jesus' dad was the carpenter, but anyway. The disciples were urging him, Rabbi, eat something. They didn't say, carpenter, eat something. So either he never corrects them. He never says, I'm not a rabbi, I'm a carpenter. Doesn't happen. The New Testament calls Jesus teacher 47 times. And teacher, which is very commonly synonymous with rabbi, certainly was back in that day, certainly does not mean someone who works wood. So, as Ken Collins says, it is very romantic to think of Jesus as a carpenter, but not very scriptural. Jesus was a rabbi. Good job, Ken. And, So, and speaking of that, this is interesting. Lincoln in Mount Vernon, New York. You have...
Hey there.
Hey, you wanted to talk about Jesus and capitalism?
No. What I wanted to do is I wanted to show that fellow who was saying that Jesus opposed socialism that the Bible actually supports, not socialism. And I don't even like the use of the word socialism because it's kind of derogatory, actually. Mm-hmm. Because when they use the word socialism, we're actually getting away from, actually speaking derogatively of what the government is supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. You see, when we hire these politicians, we put them on a pedestal and we sign we want their autographs, etc. They're not supposed to be treated that way. They're supposed to be treated as servants.
Yeah. The Constitution doesn't say leader, it says representatives.
Regardless of what the Constitution says, because I don't necessarily like to quote from people because I am an original thinker and I could come up with things with thoughts as good as George Washington or any of them, you know. And I'm saying that the purpose of government is to serve people. And so I'm going to show this fellow that the Bible actually supports that.
Okay.
And
it's go for it.
Ecclesiastics chapter 5, verse 9. It says, moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Moreover, the profit of the land.
And that's
is
profit, not prophet.
No. That would be insane to say it like that.
Right.
It says, moreover, the profit of the land is for all.
Right.
And then it's qualified. The king himself is served from the field.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's also the concept of the Jubilee. You know, every 7 years the fields had to lay fallow, but every 49 years or every 50th year, every 7 times 7 years plus one, all wealth was redistributed. All wealth was thrown into a pot, and everybody became equally rich or poor every 50 years. I mean, that was the Jubilee.
Even the concept of riches and poverty. You see, I study the Bible, but I study other disciplines too. Mm. But I don't study the Bible the way other people study it, you know, like in some kind of a serial way, you know.
Yeah.
Try to be.
I got it. Lincoln, I think you've done a fine job. Thank you for sharing that Ecclesiastes verse with us. That was a very good contribution. Rich in Oneida, Tennessee. Hey, Rich. Proverbs?
Yes, it's Proverbs 28:27.
Mm-hmm.
Says, he that giveth unto the poor shall not lack, but he that hideth his eyes shall have many a curse.
Now that, you know, our conservative guy probably would say, and he's not here to say it, but, I kind of know how these guys think. He would say, that is not saying that the government should take your money and give it to other people. That's saying that you should be doing private charity. So that's
he would like to talk around the bush.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, but I agree that all of these comments are pretty profound or pretty hard to take. It's pretty hard to take anything in the Bible as, and particularly in the New Testament, as capitalist. Really, it's as Jesus being a capitalist and taking it as socialism or as the previous caller said, whatever you want to call it, come up with another term. makes perfect sense. Millicent in Brooklyn. Hey, Millicent, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I'm in honor to speak to you.
Well, thank you for calling.
Oh, my gosh. I can't. Oh, I'm emotional. I did not know I could ever get to speak to you. I've tried many times. But I agree with what you're saying about the president kind of talking about the 99% and the 1%. I think that's wonderful.
Yes.
I love, 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 love your show. Thank you for the school that you built. I did send in a donation.
Oh, thank
you. I hope that you'll come to New York one day and I'll be able to be in line to see you and to touch you.
I hope so, too. In fact, we're trying to set up a book signing in New York in the next couple of weeks, and I would love to get up there. Millicent, thank you for your kind words. And thanks for listening to WWRL, and thanks for your call. I look forward to meeting with you. Ali in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Ali, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's great to finally talk to you. I'm a Ron Paul libertarian, and you've said things that have kind of shaken my faith, at least momentarily. But I feel a little bit more reassured when it comes to the healthcare debate. I want to see if I can bring you on my side of the fence on that.
Go for it.
I believe people look at the healthcare costs today, regardless of the fact that over the last couple of years they've been stagnant, but they've basically gone up in the past 40 or 50. And they ask why are healthcare costs so high right now? And I think the better question is, why were they ever so low? And the reason for that is because we've separated through third-party providers the transaction of, you know, I pay and you set a price. We put insurance companies and government in between those two as third-party providers, and neither one is better than the other. And I believe that the individual states, they have the insurance mandates that say if you get insurance, basically you have to have this on your plan, kind of like the minimum wage. If you hire somebody, you have to pay them at least this amount. It's kind of the same thing, except for insurance. And, you know, just like
if you don't like that.
No, I don't. I think the individual should decide what they have.
Okay, so you're trying to convince me to your way of thinking. So let me ask you a couple questions, okay?
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it's I am convincible. I have changed my mind.
Me too.
What is the whole point of healthcare?
The point of healthcare is to care for people who need it.
Well, it seems to me that's half of it. It seems to me that half of it is if I break my leg or if I get a disease, I'd like to be able to get it treated. But it seems to me that the other half of it is that when I walk from this studio over to Union Station and take the subway over to the TV studio, I would like to know that the probably 200 or 300 people that I'm going to be within 20 feet of, none of them are coughing tuberculosis on me. In other words, there's a public health issue, too. Are you with me?
I would prefer that as healthcare.
So healthcare becomes not just an issue of my getting well. It becomes an issue of my living in a well society. So that at that level then, and this is and where I really got this, and I've told this story before, and it's in one of my books. Back in the 80s, I was in India. We were taking over a leper colony, oddly enough. And I had flown I forget the city, but anyway, in the magazine in the airplane, they were talking about how 10% of the country had tuberculosis. And when I got to the airport, there was a guy coughing his lungs out into a wastebasket, and the people had like a petri dish. There's this giant like 100-foot circle around him. Nobody would go inside that circle because everybody knew this guy is contagious. And that's why I think we should all have health care. Yeah, Ali, you're going to have to call me back. I'm sorry. I hate these breaks, but we got
to
do it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But ponder that. Just think about that. And if you can come back to me with a libertarian argument that covers the public good as well as the private good, maybe we can come up with something. And welcome back, Marilyn, in Oakland, California, watching on Free Speech TV. Marilyn, what's on your mind today?
Voting rights, Tom. It's always voting rights for me. I think it's an absolutely critical issue.
Yeah.
Because without the freedom to vote, we are going to keep losing offices that then help curtail more voting rights. So I can't remain silent with this Supreme Court gutting of our Voting Rights Act. The only thing I could think of to do, and what I've done, is try and create a direct, cogent, simple petition on Move On that says restore Section 4, make it apply to every state in the nation with no provision to opt out ever. And
I would sign that.
Those who want to sign it can find it easily by going to signon.org, scrolling down on the homepage, and on the left-hand column, there's a search box, search for petitions.
Mm-hmm.
The name of mine is Strengthen Voting Rights Act.
Okay. Strengthen Voting Rights Act. At signon.org, and this is part of moveon.org?
It's part of Move On. You can also find it by going to moveon.org/petitions.
Okay. Great.
But it's, you know, either one will get you to the same homepage.
Okay. Marilyn, you got the message out to a lot of people. I hope many of them sign up, and I will, if I can catch the time here in the next hour, I'll try and get over there myself. Marilyn, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you, and good on you for being an activist. Marty in Encinitas, California, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Marty.
Yeah, hi, thanks, Tom. What great calls. Thank you, Marilyn. I'm writing this down as I'm talking. And Grant, right on. I mean, dressing as the Pope in front of your local paper in case they won't print what the Pope said was just brilliant.
It was.
Just brilliant. My other comment is on the, you mentioned the porno. They're starting to pay attention now to visiting porno sites, which is a spin-off of what's been learned by what was disclosed by Edward Snowden. And I think both Edward Snowden and Bradley Manning are heroes.
I agree.
And, feel very, very, very seriously about that. And this is sort of an interesting spin-off, and I was laughing because what you also mentioned, that the highest porno user viewers who probably, you know, buy stuff through the internet and get it through the mail are you guys in Utah, white old guys in Utah.
Right.
And then also,
it's a fact.
Because it's the time for raising money, they can't get wine, so they can't get wine.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Constitution with you signed. So yeah. I just thought that was an odd thing and probably very good for local fair trade liquor stores.
Yeah, probably is.
I never heard of a dry state in a long time.
Yeah, it's.
Anyway.
Yeah, these are old blue laws. It's unfortunate. Yeah. So that was your summary,
that's
Marilyn?
It.
For Marty?
I'm just noticing things. Noticing things, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for calling, and thanks for your kind comments and your thoughtful comments. And particularly about the irony of Utah. I hadn't caught it that Utah is one of the states that Free Speech TV can't ship, or the organic wine company is actually doing it for them, can't ship wine to. And they are the highest porn users in the country per capita. Anyhow, we'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Hessel in Temple City, California. What's up, Hessel?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to comment to you about how the, you know, somehow the website out here on Obamacare is somehow working out here in California.
Mm-hmm.
And I just... what I'm confused on is just how, you know, I hear all the conservative pundits on TV and all my conservative relatives talk about, no, this is the way government can't do anything right. And I just nod my head. I sometimes just don't know what to say because
there's
nothing I can say. You know, I say facts and it just, I don't know. It's made, I don't know if it's cognitive dissonance or I don't know what it is, really.
I think when people say to me government can't do anything right, I say Marine Corps.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
for a little bit, actually.
You know, really? Seriously? Government can't do anything right? Okay, let's dissolve the army. I mean, really? Excellent point, Hessel. So I'm glad to hear that the Obamacare website is working well for you. They're out in California, too. Excellent point. Thank you for the call. Sheila in Los Angeles. Hey, Sheila, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's great to be able to talk to you. My husband and I have been great fans of yours for years, so thank you for everything that you do. I wanted to talk about the misconceptions about disability benefits in this country. I never thought that I'd have to be on disability. I had my own company for years. We lived and worked in Beverly Hills and sent our kids to good schools and everything, and then I got horribly sick and had to rely on disability benefits. And this country, there's this whole sentiment that we're taking care of people and that it's a nanny, you know, that we're taking care of people and they don't deserve to be taken care of. And people don't realize how very low disability benefits are, that they're, the SSI is ridiculously low. You're taxed on it at the end of the year. They send you a 1099 for it. You have to pay for your Medicare. That doesn't come free. They remove money for that.
Yeah, you can thank Reagan for both those things.
Right. And no one, you know, really knows who's on. But I'm very lucky that my family is able to help us out somewhere to make ends meet. But when I ask people, well, what's the alternative? Someone actually suggested that maybe I could be a bag lady and then I could get welfare. It's just there's no real solution for people with disabilities. And I think it's shameful the way we don't take care of people in this country.
I agree. And I think a lot of that comes out of our public discourse. And our public discourse has been so coarsened since the, largely since the election of Ronald Reagan, since the elevation of wealth to becoming a high value rather than a, used to be the wealthy people were not ostentatious. And they either hid their wealth or they were at least, you know, modest about it. And with the Reagan presidency. And since then, it's been, oh, you know, look how much money I've got. And this guy's got it, or that guy's got it, or whatever. And I think the consequence of that is that coarsening of our dialogue, which causes us to feel less compassionate, less compassion for those who are in need of it. And but that's the bad news. The good news is if you listen to President Obama's speech today, and it's really worth listening to, what you find is that that dialogue is softening. That dialogue is changing. He's talking about the poor. He's talking about inequality. He's talking about working people and work having dignity. He's talking about the important stuff. He didn't talk specifically about we need to raise SSI, you know, payments. But this is, we're moving in that direction. And so I think it's a good start. Sheila, thank you for sharing your experience and thank you for calling. It's very kind of you. Brian in Chicago. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Tom. First, I just want to say thanks. I've been listening to your station for probably about almost a year now since I moved to Chicago, and it's really expanded my way of thinking. And,
oh, great. WCPT is a wonderful station.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's good. So I just mainly called because I got in right off work and heard the guest talking about Jesus being a capitalist, and that's just totally – I mean, I grew up in a Christian home, and, you know, that type of teaching. And I totally don't agree with what he was saying. You know, if anything, I do believe he was a socialist. Jesus' whole life was devoted to people and to serving people. And as I was waiting online, I just thought of the miracle that he did feeding the 5,000. You know, he took the two fishes and the bread.
Right.
You know, that's in a way socialism. You know, if everybody just would donate a little bit, we could take care of everybody.
Yeah.
So it's just, to me, that was just the point I was thinking of. So
great, Brian. Thank you for sharing. That's and thanks for your kind words about WCPT. I agree. It's one of America's great radio stations. John in Van Nuys, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, how are you?
Fine. What's on your mind, John?
Oh, let's see. So actually, I was thinking of things as I was waiting on hold too. Randy Rhodes had kind of brought this up earlier about turning things around on conservatives. You know, and then you notice that most of them will gladly tell you how Christian they are. And, you know, just like your last caller was mentioning, too, you know, Jesus fed the hungry, healed the sick, all for free, right?
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, anytime I ever bring this up in a chat room or I debate a conservative and I invoke whatever you want to call it, the nuclear Jesus option.
Right. Yeah, it blows up their head. John, just a quick heads up. We only have 50 seconds left in the show. You wanted to make a point about the Philippines?
Yeah. Actually, I just got back from the Philippines on Monday. I left last Saturday, got stuck in China, lost my passport. So I had to go through the motions of getting another passport in one day. on the subway, I'm listening to all these people hack their brains out, and I'm like looking around going, oh my God, I'm going to get sick. I'm going to get something. So I don't know if I got sick there, but when I finally got into the Philippines, it's the same thing. You get on the jeepneys, you around people, at least out of 10 people, you'll listen to four with like a really heavy cough.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up the stats online, 56 people die per day from TB in the Philippines per day.
Right, from tuberculosis.
So you're sitting there just like frightened going, oh my God, well, I ended up getting dengue fever and I'm still recovering from it.
Oh my.
It's the kind of thing that we want to see.
So you're getting back to my point that healthcare is not just about fix my broken arm. It's about keep our society healthy.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. John, brilliant. Thank you very much. And thanks so much for listening to KPFK. The great Pacifica station out there in Los Angeles. Tomorrow, conservatives can't wait to get their hands on the funds from the pending BP oil disaster settlement. We'll tell you why when I challenge conservative Daniel Rothschild of the R Street Institute. Attorney Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio, is going to be here, plus conservative Tony Katz, who says big labor is bullying fast food workers, really. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag your it. Get out there and occupy
something. You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com and our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.